Today is July the 22nd, 2020.
What time is it? It's time for the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Time and the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org.
A news alert. Marty Winston of News Tips alerted me to a press release from Pure Products that may endanger people. In a Friday press release on Business Wire, Pure Products, located in Huntington Beach, California, announced two consumer-facing hypochlorous acid foggers. That's HYPOCHLOROUS. Hypochlorous acid foggers, including an in-use photo in an occupied room. The CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control, identifies hypochlorous acid as causing dermatitis, aggravation of pre-existing asthma and asthma-like symptoms, skin and respiratory tract irritation, and mucous membrane respiratory infections from colds and flu to COVID-19. This fogging may also promote bleaching of interior rooms and their contents. We believe this merits a warning to those we reach and encourage you to investigate. We'll have more to report on this as we get it.
The FCC votes to make 988 a new suicide hotline number. The Federal Communications Commission unanimously voted Thursday to finalize 988 as a new number for Americans to call to reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. The rule approved by the commissioners will require all phone service providers to direct 988 calls to the line by July the 16th, 2022. In the interim, Americans seeking help should continue to call 1-800-273-TALK. Establishing the easy-to-remember 988 as the 911 for suicide prevention and mental health services will make it easier for Americans in crisis to access the help they need and decrease the stigma surrounding suicide and mental health issues. The suicide rate in the United States has been climbing for decades, ranking as the 10th leading cause of death in the United States since 2018. More than 48,000 Americans died by suicide in 2018, according to public data. The president signed the legislation in 2018 directing the FCC to begin studying the use of three-digit code for the hotline. The agency commissioners then approved the 988 number in December, initiating the rulemaking process. It's hard to believe it took a year and a half to decide the number will be 988. Government moves at a glacial pace.
Why is there a coin shortage in the United States? The coronavirus outbreak has created a new nationwide shortage, coins. A growing number of businesses have had to stop giving change in coins. Many are asking customers to use cards or exact change whenever possible. While some smaller businesses and franchises have stopped accepting cash altogether. The shortage is especially troubling for people who are unbanked and rely on cash for everyday purchases. Cash-only businesses are also suffering. Independent Community Bankers of America, that's the ICBA, a trade group for small banks, views the issue as a circulation problem rather than a shortage. With the coronavirus outbreak, many shifted the way they pay. They weren't paying in cash, so they weren't taking it to restaurants and banks and getting it into circulation. The coin shortage is just the latest shortage. Previously, customers had to deal with a lack of toilet paper, followed by a shortage of meat and poultry caused by the closing of meat processing plants. How did the coin shortage happen? The problem is two-pronged. The U.S. Mint significantly reduced its production of coins after implementing safety measures to protect its employees from the coronavirus. According to the Federal Reserve, consumers are also depositing fewer coins at U.S. financial institutions. And because of coronavirus fears, many people have switched to using credit cards and mobile payments to avoid handling money. Meanwhile, the shutdown also forced some businesses to close that would normally help keep coins moving. A spokesperson for the U.S. Mint said, with establishments like retail shops, bank branches, transit authorities, and laundromats closed, the typical places where coin enters our society has slowed or even stopped the normal circulation of coin. Last month, on June the 15th, the Federal Reserve said it would start capping the amount of coins that allocates to banks and financial institutions. The measure is expected to be temporary and based on institutions' historical orders. When will the coin shortage end? The Federal Reserve and the U.S. Mint, along with other financial groups, are working to fix the problem, but it's unclear when the shortage will end. We feel like we're making progress, Jerome Powell, chair of the Federal Reserve, said in June at the House Financial Services Committee hearing. It's been something that we've been working on. On June 30th, the Fed announced that a task force will create a plan to deal with the problem. The task force, comprised of leaders from big banks, associations, the Fed, and the Department of the Treasury, and they had their first meeting on July 10th, and is expected to share lists of recommendations in early August. So they announced a meeting on June the 30th, and they met July 10th. Boy, it must have been a very urgent meeting to wait 10 days. Some of the questions the group is mulling over. Did the pandemic throw a curveball, and do we need to rethink the way coins are stored or delivered? Are there ways to streamline the supply chain to get coins out now? How do we alter the supply chain to push coin out? Meanwhile, the U.S. Mint returned to full production in mid-June and expects to produce 19.8 billion coins by the end of the year, 7.4 billion more than last year. What should consumers do in the meantime? While the Fed's work to improve coin inventory and the U.S. Mint churns out more coins, there's one big part of the problem that still needs addressing. Consumers. Consumers should consider depositing the coins at a bank or spending them at a local business to get the coins back into circulation. If they've been putting away coins on a rainy day fund, I can't think of a better way that these funds can be used now. The challenge will be the biggest for businesses, which are running short on coins and may not be able to get their full order of coins from the banks. But some businesses are finding ways around the problem. Kroger, for example, is giving consumers digital change on a customer loyalty card, which can be redeemed on the next trip to the store. So, as I reported in a previous news item, it took a long time to think about what that three-digit phone number is for people who may be thinking of suicide and needs mental health. Now we have a task force to determine how to get more coins out. Just get the damn coins out. We don't need a task force.
Mozilla launches a standalone VPN service for Android and Chromebook. Mozilla, the company behind the Firefox browser, has announced that it's bringing a private VPN to Android, Chromebook, and Windows as a standalone service. The firm, best known for its line of browsers that come in a variety of flavors on mobile and desktop, is charging $4.99 per month to access to its VPN service. No good VPN is ever free, after all. It is currently only in the beta phase. While the U.S. has had access for just short of a month in beta, Mozilla has now confirmed that it is officially available and rolling out to further 5 countries. If you're based in the U.K., Canada, New Zealand, and Singapore, or Malaysia, then you should now be able to join up with the $5 per month subscription relative to your local currency. The waitlist is still open for a wider rollout, though, so rest assured that the Mozilla Firefox VPN will expand yet further still over the coming months. However, if you can get signed up, you'll have access to servers in over 30 countries with no logging of browsing data. If that seems like a good deal to you, then you can sign up. So after a little over 4 months of closed beta testing, the Mozilla Firefox VPN is now in open beta for anyone in the United States after being officially announced, and that means that you no longer have to join a wait list to give the VPN a try, which might be useful if you're still working from home and want some added privacy controls, or you simply want to get around the Netflix region locking. The Mozilla VPN is available right now for Windows, iOS, and Android with dedicated Mac and Linux apps set to come at some point soon. Pricing also seems reasonable, with protection and connection for up to 5 devices, priced at $5 a month. Mozilla also confirmed that the open beta will run for a few more weeks before a fully fledged public rollout. For those outside of the United States, we'll see region-by-region update over the coming months. If you are desperate to give Mozilla VPN a try, then you will have to join the global waitlist. However, if you're in the United States and want to have more control of your data and internet traffic, then you can download the Mozilla VPN. There is already a free tier of the Mozilla VPN that is enabled by downloading a browser extension. This service will offer full device protection, with Mozilla claiming that absolutely no logging of network traffic or browsing history will take place. It will rely on a new WireGuard protocol, which is said to be faster and more secure than other popular protocols such as OpenVPN. Those who do eventually get connected once invites are sent out will be able to connect up to 5 devices to the VPN at the same time and access servers in more than 30 countries. That might not seem all that impressive, but not many VPN providers are completely transparent on what happens to your data. It's also worth noting that the service will be available to most Android devices, no matter which version you have pre-installed. Microsoft will surely have the wrath of Windows 10 users by killing off one of its most useful features. Part of the control panel is getting dropped. It appears that Microsoft is going ahead with its plans to drop the useful system applet from the control panel and instead force people to use a settings app that was first introduced with Windows 8. This change in navigation will annoy a lot of people because the system part of control panel is genuinely very useful, giving you an overview of your PC, such as what processor and amount of RAM you have installed, along with quick links to your PC manufacturer's support website and more. However, with the recently released Windows 10 build 20161, which is an early version of an upcoming 10 update that's been released to people who want to test it, the system section of the control panel now just takes you to the settings app. Whenever Microsoft removes a feature from Windows 10, especially a genuinely useful one, it usually encounters a backlash. In this case, by forcing people to use a settings app, it will actually make things worse. The settings app was introduced with Windows 8, and like most of the things that came with that unpopular operating system, it was derided for being too simplistic and pared back compared to legacy Windows tools. The good news, at least, is that over the years, the settings app have been improved, and the one found in Windows 10 is a lot more useful. This seems to be part of Microsoft's plan to eventually kill off Control Panel altogether and replace it with Setting App. Microsoft needs to ensure that Settings App is up to scratch before it kills off the Control Panel entirely. This new move looks like Microsoft is slowly migrating features to the Settings App in preparation. Why don't they make changes which are really big and important instead of these little minor changes?
It wasn't just me. Windows 10 May 2020 update complaints are still being reported. Update is slowing down games and causing eSent warnings. Numerous people who have upgraded to Windows 10 May 2020 update are seeing eSent warnings as well as suffering problems with reduced performance. Users looking at the event viewer see multiple eSent warnings with the event ID 642. In addition to seeing these warnings, some people are complaining of reduced game performance in titles such as Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six Siege and Call of Duty Warzone. The eSent.dll is used by various components of Windows, and it's not clear what particular events are triggering the warning. But as reported, there are plenty of complaints popping up online in Microsoft's own forums, on Reddit, and other sites. The warnings are varied, making references to Microsoft Edge, Windows Catalog Database, and Video.ui. As if the unexplained errors were not enough, some users are crashing, blue screens of death, and massively reduced frame rates in games. Microsoft has not acknowledged that there is a problem, so there is currently no official fix or workaround. However, rolling back to a pre-Windows 10 May 2020 update, build addresses the issues for many people, while others report that the problems just fix themselves over time. The self-fixing appears to be related to the removal of Windows.old folder, but this has not been confirmed. Maybe you found it while searching for big files clobbing up your drive, or this is news to you. Why is it there? What do you do with Windows.old? The Windows.old folder contains all the important files, user data, program files, Windows files, and so on, from the older version of Windows that was installed on your computer. What is the Windows.old folder and how do you get rid of it? Although for most people, Windows.old is redundant and can be left alone, deleting it could be a good way to free up tons of space, especially on a small solid-state drive. What does Windows.old do? The Windows.old folder is essentially just what it sounds like. It's your old version of Windows. If you upgraded from Windows 7 or 8.1 to Windows 10, then you will have Windows.old folder located in your C drive. The same goes for if you updated to any major versions of Windows 10, Creators Update, April Update, and so on. Windows.old is a backup of the system you just updated in case something goes wrong with the upgrade. If you find the new system doesn't work or you don't like the state of things after it's completed, you can just roll back using Windows 10 built-in rollback feature. There's a catch though. If you had a virus that was affecting your system and you decided to reinstall a fresh copy of the operating system, Windows.old can easily carry forward the virus, as it still retains all physical data existing on your drive prior to the update. However, you do only have a set amount of time to do so. Windows 10 updates before 2016 Anniversary Edition keep Windows.old around for 30 days to give almost a month to roll back the system if you wanted to do this. Since Microsoft discovered that most people who do use the rollback feature do it within the first day or two of completing an update, now it keeps the Windows.old around for much less time. If you're running one of the latest versions of Windows 10, then you only have 10 days after updating to take advantage of the backup Windows.old affords you. After that point, you need to do a full reinstall to take things back to the way they were. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell on his continuing IT Pro series, featuring Why Does IT Always Report to Finance? Hey, isn't that where the money is?
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time for business. This is where I'm going to give you my current and past experience of being a 30-year IT professional. 3 decades of this. Now, Sasha reached out and asked, why does IT always report to finance? Is it because of nerds working together? Is it because it's a cost center? And it's kind of funny because, in a way, yeah, both of those answers are correct. I'm going to underscore them, though. I'm going to go down both of those roads. The first road, all right, let's talk about the first people who are really bringing in computers into business. They were the number crunchers. They were the guys who were buying, of all things, now we're going back to the early 80s, there was a computer called the Osborne Portable. Now, let me tell you about the Osborne Portable. It was purchased a lot by CPAs, accountants, who could lug this 25 some odd pound computer, and they could sit down at any desk as long as they had power, and they could start entering in all of this data and crunching numbers so much faster because they had this computer program that just handled numbers. Now, that's going back into the early 80s. So somebody had to come along and make sure those computers were running. Somebody had to serve the business, at least as far as the computers were concerned. So the first controllers, CFOs, and people like that were hiring the assistants to fix the computers while they crunched the numbers because they couldn't be involved with all of the rest. But then they would train those same technicians to do reports. They had a certain natural ability to work with computers. They had a certain finesse with the computers that allowed them to be quite trainable, pick up a lot of these different details, and to serve the business not from so much a lot of the number crunching side of, you know, this is the checks we need to write and this is our balance sheet and all of that, but let's start applying these computer aspects to some of the other parts of the company. I will tell you that actually those number crunchers, those bean counters, sorry guys, they actually helped IT. They helped all of us. They allowed us to find new ways to bring the company forward, new efficiencies, new abilities for the company to be successful. And that's exciting. All of this stuff is always very exciting. So by doing this, they changed a lot of the aspect here. Now, as things continued on, the roles became a little bit more separated because, yes, the guy who went off to accounting school or whatever, he wasn't so much interested in continually chasing down the roads of making the business better. He already had so many other things that he was supposed to be working on, sales projections and things like that. So the IT guy went forward. So as part of history, we still do frequently report in through finance. I can go back through most of my positions, and I either worked directly for in small companies, directly for the CEO, or I worked for somebody in finance, a controller, comptroller, things like that. Even in the larger companies that I've worked at, I can tell you that it has to be a fairly large company before the CIO, Chief Information Officer, CTO, Chief Technology Officer, become separated from the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer. Sometimes they have, yes, a CFO will still have the CIO or CTO reporting to them. And sometimes they're equals. And it's kind of a very interesting thing. Now, the other thing that Sasha asked about, is it because it's a cost center? And the reality is, yes. At least that's how it's perceived by the company. People who are not familiar with all of the power that IT has, all of the different things that IT can do for your business, for their business, those people who have no knowledge of all of that, do think of IT as a cost center. What do you mean we've got to pay $50,000 to buy these servers? We've been using the existing servers for years and they haven't had any problems. Yeah, they haven't had any problems because you've got a brilliant IT nerd who's back there keeping everything running with a minimal budget. But at a certain point in time, you're going to have to spend money. So yeah, there are large chunks of change that get involved with very small amounts of computer equipment. And yeah, it takes a certain level of skill and finesse to explain why something is so important to a company, why something is so valuable to the company. And guess what? There's a symbiotic relationship, because I'll tell you, I can give some of those basic numbers off to my CFO, my controller, whoever it is, the financial guy. And he goes, okay, I can understand that. Tell me, answer me this question, this question, this question. All right. I will go to bat with the CEO, with, you know, the president of the company or whoever it is, and I'll get this done. So, yeah, it actually does work out pretty well. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin.
A topic of interest today is cord cutting. Satellite and digital cable in the 1980s and 1990s were one of the most common sources for news and entertainment. But technological advances such as on-demand streaming services have challenged cable TV's place in the market. Many consumers have chosen to cut their pay TV subscriptions altogether. According to a Nielsen report, the average household receives about 190 channels. Over the last 6 years, consumers' watch remained consistently around 17. Estimates of 73% of U.S. citizens have cable TV. Is cable TV losing subscribers? People are cutting the cord and turning to internet TV streaming. It's normally cheaper. There are a number of streaming services that are viable alternatives. Netflix is dubbed the best cord-cutting service, while Hulu, the best cable streaming service. Will streaming services take over cable? What we do know is that streaming is now more popular than cable TV subscription. It is projected that 55.1% of Americans will have cut the cord by 2022. This number will only grow. Comcast and DirecTV have lost 4.7 million customers between 2017 and 2019. It was perhaps worse news for Comcast because DirecTV managed to redirect a proportion of the customers that they lost to their own internet TV service. Others went to competitors like YouTube TV and Sling TV. Verizon and Charter also reported widespread losses. 82% of U.S. adults streaming internet TV claim it is more entertaining than cable. There could be a number of different reasons for this, like more channels to choose from or cheaper prices. However, U.S. adults agree that streaming is more entertaining than traditional cable TV, according to pay TV subscriber statistics. Cable TV subscribers stats in 2020 indicate there will be a 28% fall in the number of pay TV subscriptions between 2013 and 2023. That's a 10-year period. And in 2013, there were 100.5 million pay TV households in the United States. By 2023, the number will fall to 72.7 million, representing a decrease of 28%. This will further change, especially considering that cable cutting stats show that the number of people switching to internet TV is increasing. Most people now subscribe to a streaming service at 69%, and only 65% pay for cable TV. In other words, more people now stream mostly through internet TV services, according to the streaming versus cable statistics in 2020. The main reason for this is that people can avoid advertising while accessing original content they cannot watch on traditional cable. And that's why it's no surprise that the live streaming market will be worth over $70 billion by 2021. What percentage of American households subscribed to cable service in 2019 have cable TV? I was a big surprise, 6.44% of American households. You might have expected a much higher percentage, but cord cutting is taking its toll. A considerable number of people simply like to watch their local news, traffic, and weather channels. You can get those free of charge with an antenna, and some of them can be pretty damn good. So if you were wondering, is TV dying? The answer is no. But why the increase in cord cutting? Most cord cutters are motivated by the opportunity to save money, control their TV experience, and or simply to have more programming choices. The average viewer in the United States can save up to $104 per month by taking the plunge in cord cutting. TV services like cable lost 1 million subscribers in the third quarter of 2018. Another 94,000 subscribers dropped their telco TV packages at this time. Verizon witnessed the biggest decline, losing roughly 63,000 subscribers. This is among the most defining trends in the cable TV industry, to further pile on the pressure for the Big Six. In 2019, 62% of adults in the United States were subscribed to a streaming service. Millennials often are on the move, and convenience is the key. In contrast, older people are more likely to keep their cable subscriptions because it's what they're familiar and comfortable with. In 2018, Comcast accounted for 23.6% of pay TV marketed in the United States. DirecTV had 21.5% of the market share. The industry is dominated by a few large companies: AT&T, Comcast, Charter, Dish Network, Verizon, and Altice USA. These top cable providers in 2018, also known as the Big Six, had 81.71 million subscribers in the last quarter of this year. But there were 33 million people in the United States who had canceled their pay TV subscriptions at some point. Cutting the cord was on the rise in 2018, showing a 32.8% increase from 2017. With streaming services like Hulu and Netflix gaining in popularity, more and more people are tempted to cut the cord. To stay competitive, the top cable providers are now bundling internet and phone services. For instance, Comcast earns a significant portion of its revenue from high-speed internet, business services, and voice options. Getting all this in a single convenient package is attractive to customers. As a result, big companies are losing subscribers at an alarming rate, and that's why they have no choice but to enter the market. Any additional profits they get may be nice, but make no mistake about it, this is also their only way to survive. What changes were there in the marketplace for television programming? In September of 2019, only 29% of American adults had never subscribed to a streaming service. As you can see, proverbial Netflix and Blockbuster is quickly transitioned to online streaming. Netflix is as hip as ever. While the company began as a DVD rental service similar to Blockbuster, it quickly transitioned to online streaming. The introduction of Netflix originals, there were new shows like House of Cards and Orange. In 2016, U.S. cable and pay TV providers generated an estimated $52 million from advertising and program revenue. They added a further $26.2 million from airtime revenue. A lot for this comes from ads aired during sports events, such as the Super Bowl and the U.S. Open tennis tournament. In 2016, cable industry subscriptions in the United States were worth $81 billion. That figure is up from $4.5 billion in 1980, and according to cable TV subscriber statistics. However, providers have witnessed a steady decline in revenue over the last few years. The industry reached a peak of $99 billion in 2013. In 2018, about 147.5 million Americans watch Netflix at least once a month. This is huge. Netflix is the most popular streaming service by far, followed by Amazon Prime Video with 88.7 million, Hulu with 55 million, and HBO Now with 17.1 million, and Dish Sling TV with 6.8 million. Just like Netflix, all these streaming services offer original programs. So if you're a fan of fantasy, you're probably watching Game of Thrones on HBO. Gearheads, on the other hand, still be turning to The Grand Tour on Amazon Prime Video. In 2018, the total revenue of Netflix amounted to around $15.79 billion, In 2019, the third quarter alone, the streaming giant had revenue of $5.2 billion. This is a crucial stat which highlights the stratosphere rise of Netflix and helps explain the dwindling number of cable TV subscribers. Its revenue was $1.36 billion a year ago, and in 2018, this number was at $16.8 billion. Netflix also employed 7,100 people all over the world, and clearly, it's going from strength to strength. What changes were there in the TV subscription business? 70% of pay TV subscribers feel they get too little value for their money. Streaming versus cable statistics show prices is the leading factor fueling cord cutting. About 56% of current pay TV customers say they keep their subscriptions because it's bundled with their home broadband. And by 2021, roughly 51 million Americans won't have cable or satellite TV subscription. Newer, cheaper television subscription plans are now surfacing. Dish Network's Sling TV and YouTube are a prime reason for cable television's decline. The number of U.S. consumers subscribing to pay TV decreased from 73% to 67% in 2018. Netflix usage surpassed cable and satellite for the first time with 76%. Everyone knew this was inevitable, even the Big Six. And the revenue streaming services generates a hefty sum. What's more, 55% of U.S. households had subscription to at least one video streaming service in 2018. That figure was up from 10% in 2009. What's new? You might be wondering if cable TV is dying. News of cable's demise is premature. What's more, some analysts even suggest a return to cable bundles might be just around the corner. Cable companies in the United States figured out a long time ago that the easiest solution to a world with tons of pay channels is to bring them together into a more affordable bundle. Some companies will probably rediscover this idea even as we proceed full steam into the streaming age. That being said, the cable TV industry continues to be in perilous waters. Comcast lost 96,000 customers during the first quarter of 2018, the fourth straight quarter of subscriber losses in 2019. It was losing over 2,500 users every day. AT&T DirecTV satellite service lost 180,000 customers in the same period, which brought down video revenue by $660 million. So what's next for the industry? According to the latest cable TV subscriber statistics, North American expenditures will continue to drop for the next couple of years. It's not, however, all doom and gloom. That being said, the industry will have to reinvent itself to survive. The brave new world of online streaming is just around the corner, especially in the United States. To stem the tide on cord cutting, all the cable TV provider has to do is to offer their own offering of skinny bundles. But they haven't done it yet. A case study of the missing Windows 10 wireless adapter. A close friend called me to assist diagnosing a problem on his daughter's HP laptop. Everything was running fine until 2 weeks ago when she was not able to connect to the internet. There was no connections with the wireless adapter. First thought was, check if the wireless adapter was turned on. He could not find the wireless adapter. I asked him to check the BIOS setting to determine if the wireless adapter was available. Nothing was amiss. I follow up by having him run the System File Checker, or SFC command, in administrative mode. The SFC command is a command prompt that can be used to verify and replace important Windows system files. System File Checker is a very useful tool to use when you suspect issues with the protected Windows files, like many DLL system files. I told him to be patient when it's running as it will take minutes. Among all the command switches, SFC/scan now is the most frequently used one. It is extremely useful to repair incorrect, corrupted, changed, or damaged system files. He called back later to say that there were numerous errors detected and notices of repaired system files. He tried to again connect to the internet via the wireless adapter. No such luck. At this point in time, I recommended he go back to a restore point more than 2 weeks ago. There were none. He said that he was able to connect to the internet, though, using the RJ45 cable to the Ethernet port. He did notice something unusual, though. Whenever he booted up the system, there was a message from McAfee asking if he wanted to install the McAfee antivirus program. He would just select no and continue running. He could not find in the startup how the message was generated each time there was a system boot. His daughter had been running with Windows Defender. He noticed it was turned off, and when he turned it back on, the McAfee message disappeared and the wireless adapter was detected. The McAfee app apparently snuck in there and it couldn't be uninstalled. When he checked in the programs and feature settings, there was no indication that McAfee was installed, but apparently it had been installed and it turned off Windows Defender. His daughter is working from home and a key tool that she uses is Citrix. Citrix Receiver is a new version of Citrix Client, which is a program that allows secure access to cloud computers. It is often used for cloud applications or for enabling remote desktop access to certain servers within the cloud. He now has one of three options. I told him to download the latest copy of Windows 10 using Media Creation from Microsoft. The main purpose of the Media Creation tool is to provide an official way to create a Windows 10 bootable disk. You can do that by creating installation media with a connected USB flash drive, DVD, or an ISO file. You may also use this utility to upgrade your current PC directly. He can do a startup boot from the USB drive. He will also have the option of reinstalling Windows 10 with the latest update. He can reinstall the Windows 10 operating system and also save the installed application and associate data. He can also just do a Windows 10 reinstall and just save the data. Since he had the problem with Citrix, I recommend that he does a complete refresh of the system. It is important to note that if you're working from home, the equipment in use should be dedicated only for your use for work. Acquire another system if there's a family need for a system. Before starting, make sure that you have backup of all your personal data. Locate your software media for application reinstallation. If you have the media but you are missing the serial ID, there are other tools to locate the serial ID depending on the version of software. If you're working from home, I would advise that you have a backup system because you're being paid to get the work done, and if you don't have a system at home, you're going to be SOL. Presenting Marty Winston on his All Hands on Tech, featuring 0 to 10 volt lighting control. Hey, isn't that called a dimmer switch? The dimmer switch you see in homes today was invented in a New York City apartment by the name Joel Spira. It was in 1959 that Spira started his dimmer switch invention and landed his patent to then start Lutron Electronics in 1961.
Even back in the days of oil lamps and alcohol lamps and kerosene lamps, well, they had their own form of brightness control. You could just let more of the wick reach up into the chimney. The flame would be bigger, the light would be brighter, and the fuel would, well, it would run out just a little sooner. Gas lights let you simply turn it up to let more gas through, at least enough to get a bigger, brighter flame. Then came electric lights. And there really wasn't much technology for making them brighter, only for making them dimmer. If you needed more light, you had to start with more light. Sometimes it meant a scheme with multiple bulbs, and you could turn some of them or all of them on at the same time. Or you could get three-way bulbs with two filaments of different wattages, call them A and B. So you could turn on just A, or just B, or be as bright as A plus B. Early on, electric light dimming was done with a rheostat, a big variable resistor. It let you adjust how much power could reach the bulb, and the rest, because it was really just a big variable resistor, got converted into heat. Enough history. Dimmers have been around forever, and they followed scores of different design paths that we won't get into here. Yes, you're welcome. Special applications like theatrical lighting were among the first to deal with the issue of controlling many of the attributes of a lot of different lights all from one place. A similar thing happened with office lighting. The Internet of Things and home automation brought some of that home. But even without automation, you could easily buy a dimmer switch. But you better make that a compatible dimmer switch, a dimmer switch to make something in your house dimmable. There are today several standards for setting the dimming or brightness of a light, but only one of those is on deck for right now. It's one of today's most broadly familiar standards called 010, short for 0 to 10 volt lighting control. And no, it isn't for lights that run on 10 volts. It's a low power, low current DC value on a pair of wires separate from the ones that power your lights. Who needs it? Why? Is it worth the trouble? What's in it for you? Yeah, all the usual questions. The answers start making sense once you understand the building blocks of modern lighting fixtures. They may still get their power from the power lines, but the parts that get bright tend to operate at much lower voltages, usually DC voltages. Those things that get bright, the arrays of light-emitting diodes, that's what LED stands for, light-emitting diodes, well, it's probably easier to just call those the emitters. In a large fixture, there's rarely a single emitter. More often, it's an array or a pattern or a cluster of emitters, usually with some kind of glass or plastic diffuser to spread the light out. Put it all together, and it's the thing that lights up. That's not too technical, is it? There's another gizmo that you'll also want to know about. It's called the driver. The driver's job description may be as simple as to convert the usually AC power that comes from the power lines into the usually DC voltages that power the parts that light up. And if you just want to turn the lights on and off, it might be just that simple. Most drivers look like a metal rectangular box with wires coming out, a bit bigger than the box the toothpaste comes in, and a bit smaller than the box of plastic storage bags. Sometimes, though, a driver will have another connection, maybe for a pair of wires, maybe for something that looks like an Ethernet connection, maybe something else. These are all ways for it to connect to some kind of something that tells it how dim or bright to make the thing light up. The 0 to 10 volt or 0-10V standard has been around a good long time since fluorescent fixtures ruled. They're even more in play today in an era of almost all LED fixtures. It's easy to understand, easy to troubleshoot, economical to implement, all good. Here's how it works. That pair of wires. For the curious, the color codes prefer them to be lavender and gray, but it's really hard to find a two-wire cable color-coded that way. So you may see red and white or red and black or almost anything else. Anyway, those two wires connect both to the driver and to a dimmer switch that supports the 010V standard. Very commonplace and probably available off the shelf within a few miles of you. The dimmer switch may have a knob or a slider in addition to the switch, or the whole thing may be a slider, maybe with a little click detent at the bottom off position, maybe also at the full on top position. You won't need instructions. Everything happens right away, so just fiddling with the switch will show you how it works. The part you don't see, as most of you have guessed by now, is that depending on where the dimmer switch is set, the voltage on that pair of wires will be something between 0 volts, which means off, and 10 volts, which means full brightness. Did you ever have an electric train? The variable speed throttle on those have that same kind of effect. Lower slower and higher faster. And yeah, it's possible for one 0 to 10 volt source to control multiple fixtures. If they're identical fixtures, same make and model and specs, and if the length of the wire connecting them isn't so long that there's a voltage drop, well, the odds for it all cooperating are on your side. If not, well, some drivers allow tweaking that can tune them to play nicely with the others. About those 010V dimmer switches, they can be simple switches, or they can be three-way switches. Would you like an example of how that can work? The basement here is office space that extends into an area that we can use as a TV studio. That area is between the central stairway up to the kitchen and the north stairs that lead up to the garage. There's one set of three switches at the garage end. These are three-way switches with no dimming features. The power for the lights comes into those switches and three cables, to be specific, 14-3 Romex. Three cables connect them to three companion switches on the wall at the central stairway. Those companion switches are also three-way switches, but with the 0-10-volt support. Two cables exit each of those three switches. One of those cables, this time 14-2 Romex, carries power to that switch's small group of fixtures. The other cable, smaller, 18-2 cable, like speaker wire, connects to the 0-10V control input on each driver in that group of fixtures, all in parallel. That's pretty doggone simple for having so many lights that all get their brightness set from the switches at the central stairway, but that you can turn on or off from either door. Those three switches are for lighting the office and the studio area. Those are the only lights we'll want to dim. There's also a light switch just inside the garage end door that has a PIR, passive infrared motion sensor, and automatically turns on when there's motion in that area. There's also a motion detector in the central stairway that turns on both one light fixture in the stairway and another near its entrance. By the way, all these LED fixtures are at a color temperature of 4,000 to 4,100 degrees Kelvin for good color rendition. We do have video to shoot after all. Next time, we're on the air to talk about air, inside air, and how to make the things that control it smarter. How to help them know what's inside the inside air. How to help them know about the outside air. Everything it needs to know in order to respond and prepare. It's a little bit of home automation involving an impressive, modern counterpart to the first automated device that homes ever had. Join us for The Thermostat is Where It's At.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Some of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For update information, visit the website of the computer club. And if you're interested in the subject itself, RSVP so you can get a meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting Thursday, July the 23rd, starting at 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. A tutorial on Google Docs. Their website is bcug.com for the Zoom meeting ID. The Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting on Tuesday, July the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom, and you can go to their website, ppcug-nj.org, and RSVP to get a meeting ID. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting Thursday, August the 13th at 7 p.m. The topic of presentation is How to Set Up RetroPie on the Raspberry Pi. RSVP at nyacc.org if you're interested for a Zoom meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 11th, and their meeting time is 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. For more information on how to get onto Amazon, RSVP to acgnj.org for more information on how you can participate via Amazon Chime. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on PRN.FM on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send me an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do your regular backups on your computer. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.